You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Well, you know, I can't wait to get into this. We may as well just start because this is going to be basically an ass-kissing session. Hope you're ready for that.
Well, I'll kiss your ass as best I can.
You see how he turns the tables on me? Ladies and gentlemen, this is The Brian Callen Show with my colleague Hunter Motz, and we have none other than Coach Bill Courtney, who's written a book called Against the Grain. If you haven't seen the Oscar-winning documentary Undefeated, you are remiss. It's one of the most inspiring things I've ever seen, man. If you don't cry, then you're not a human being. Coach, I know, look, I've seen a lot of your interviews. You're out there doing this book tour. And I'll be honest with you, after seeing Undefeated, I thought to myself, I don't need to read the book because I've seen it all in the documentary. And, you know, and what we pride ourselves on in this podcast is we read the book. We don't just skim it. We read it so that we can do. I know how hard it is to write anything. So let's get into it, man. And by the way, I'm glad I read it. And it's an important book, and I want to get into that. I'm glad I read it, and I realize it's very relevant. There are a lot of ideas in this book that you'd call old-fashioned, out of fashion. But, man, are they relevant. As I get older, I start to realize that and appreciate that more. You called it Against the Grain. Let's go into why you called it that first.
Well, if you only know me from Undefeated or you don't know me at all, my real world is, I started a business off my couch in 2001, kind of on a wing and a prayer with a two-year-old, a three-year-old, a four-year-old, a five-year-old, and a supportive wife. And
she better be supportive, by the way.
Yeah, well, no kidding. I was 31 years old and was a vice president of a pretty large company and left a really nice job to do it and kind of risked everything. And it's in the lumber business. And now I have 120 employees and offices in Shanghai and Ho Chi Minh. Just been very blessed as the business has grown. But it's in the lumber business. And, you know, when you take a rough piece of lumber that was just cut, and you run your hand across it, you're going to get splinters in it. It's not really that pretty. And then you dry it through kilns and then you sand it against its grain. And when you sand it, it becomes smooth. And I'm in the hardwood business, which is walnut and oak and cherry and the jewels of the forest, the most beautiful woods there are. And you, after you sand it, you take it and you build these pieces of furniture that are family heirlooms. And the metaphor is, you know, you take something that's rough and difficult and can actually hurt you and splinter your hand, but through sanding it and working it against the grain, you create something timeless that can be passed down from generation to generation that's beautiful. Mm. And likewise, my other life is football. And, you know, you rarely see the old clips when they're doing, you know, the old greatest moments of football of some guy just outrunning the defense. It's when Barry Sanders or some of the greatest running backs kind of stick their foot in the ground and cut back into the teeth of the defense and break tackles and spin around into the teeth of defense and make those awe-inspiring runs. And a run like that in football terminology is cutting back against the grain. So in both of my lives, football and the lumber business, when you go against the grain, it is the most painstaking effort, but it's what creates the most timeless, memorable things that you always hold dear in your life. And when I wrote my book, I think these 14 tenets that I discuss are difficult to do, and they will leave splinters on you, and you do have to cut back into the teeth of people that oppose you. But when you do, you create this timeless life that leaves a legacy that people will remember forever. And so the challenge of Against the Grain, it's not a football book. The challenge of Against the Grain is in your families and in society and in politics and in your businesses, at workplace. We need to start cutting back against the grain of today's societal preconceived notions about so many different things. And if we do, we can leave a legacy that will be awe-inspiring and memorable for years after we're gone.
Well, that was what, you know, I thought was so unique about the book. I have not seen, You know, when you see a book like this, and you know, it's a well undefeated and all, and you figure, I mean, against the grain, and you figure, well, usually you can kind of predict a lot of these books and what they're going to say, work hard and be a good person. But you've got things in this book and chapters in this book I'd actually never seen and thought about. For example, the search.
Good, by the way.
Yeah.
Good. That's the whole point.
It was. Service is not someone else's job. I mean, the search for civility. I'd never really thought about this. And you use the example. George Washington had a sort of a civility manifesto and how important civility is in a society. It just wasn't something I'd thought about. Grace appears in a forgiving heart. I mean, there's a lot of stuff here that you talk about that I want to get into that kind of was very surprising to me. I just had never thought, you know, I spent a lot of time trying to be the best I can be, and I got kids, and you want to raise them with at least, you know, an idea of what, you know, fortitude and temperance and all the things that we you know, try to instill in people, young people especially, or ourselves. But there was stuff here, man, that I had taken for granted. First of all, when you speak about God, you're obviously a Christian man, but can you just, and I don't want to get too into religion and things, but what does it mean? What does God mean to you? I mean, what does being a good man mean?
Well, that's two separate questions.
Yeah.
Because there are plenty of people that don't believe in my God that are very good people.
Exactly.
And first, there's a big difference in being religious and being faithful. And there are a lot of religious that make me want to vomit, frankly. and, well, it's true.
Yep.
And so, first, I am a Christian. But that is my personal faith. That is my personal walk. And there are fantastic human beings out there that are Hindu and Jewish and Muslim and Buddhist and agnostic. And so just because I'm a Christian and that's my personal faith, that does not mean that I think that if you don't agree with me and my belief and my spirituality, that you're wrong and I'm right and we can't find common ground. And those that are overly religious, I think, are the biggest detriments to people understanding what the true Christian faith is. So, having said that, what does God and faith mean to me? If you had to sum it up in a word, it is forgiveness. You know, a Christian believes that Christ came here so that we could repent and be saved from our sins. Well, there is no Christianity without Christ, and there's no reason for Christ if there is no such thing as forgiveness, because that's what the whole point is. And so when it boils down to it, I mean, we could talk 4 hours on this, but when it boils down to it, when in chapter 13 we talk about grace appears in a forgiving heart, the 30,000-foot view is this. How, as a faithful Christian, am I supposed to accept and expect forgiveness from who I think is the God of the universe and then turn around and very hypocritically not offer forgiveness and grace to another fallen human being? So if you understand that is the faith, not the religion, but the faith, then when someone wrongs you or when someone in your charge makes a mistake, i.e. an employee, a player, a child, and certainly not in your charge, but maybe even your spouse, we are called to be forgiving, and it is more important for the forgiver than the forgiven, because if you think about it, it's pretty simple. If you're harboring a bunch of anger and ill will and resentment, that's going to make you unhappy. So if you're unforgiving, you will be unhappy, and you can't be happy if you're unhappy. So the basis of grace and forgiveness, in my mind, is to lead a happy and fulfilled life, you have to understand the tenet of forgiveness. You have to understand why you need to use it. And you have to understand that if you do harbor ill will and if you do harbor hate and anger as a result of something or something that's happened to you or someone's done to you, you're only hurting yourself. And if you call yourself a Christian, you're an unbelievable hypocrite to expect that forgiveness but not grant it.
Hmm. You got away with words, sir. You got away with words. Me and Hunter are just sitting there going, I never even thought of that difference. Yeah. You know, we got all these intellectuals.
Well, I mean, that's, brother, that's to me, that's truly, honestly, what it's all. If you've seen Undefeated, I get asked all the time, why didn't you give up on Chavis? How did you keep? Well, here's why, because the guy came to me and said, I don't know why I'm so angry, coach. I don't know why I'm this. I'm sorry. And then he'd blow up again, but he would legitimately come and say, you know, I don't know why. I don't know why I'm sorry. He was a fallen, hurt, lost person. Mm. And what kind of jerk would I be to expect forgiveness from a God that I believe in and then not turn around and grant it to a lost, hurt human being? I mean, it's not something nice to do. Mm. It is required of us. Mm. And that's just it. That's just really, to me, what the understanding of a grace is. But understand, you don't have to be a Christian to understand the power of forgiveness. You don't have to be a Christian to understand the power of grace. That's just my reality. But I think the lesson crosses all religious and faith lines.
Yeah. Well, because it's something human. I mean, that's the thing.
It's very human. Yeah. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And look, I want... When I was up at Fox in New York, they said, Bill, you know, the taboo items are kind of race, religion, politics, faith,
sure.
Entitlements.
That's why I said a lot of these ideas are out of fashion. I mean, they're not, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and they looked at me and says, Bill, your book is on race, religion, politics. And I said, yeah, but here's the thing. We've got to have a civil discord, and we've got to be non-threatening and sit across the table, sit across the table, figuratively speaking, from people who don't necessarily have our own reality and think just like we do and have conversations about this stuff. Political correctness and the fear to speak about the stuff that matters is killing us. We have a 50% divorce rate in this country. We've got a 15% approval of Congress. We've got a 40% approval of the White House. We've got all kinds of issues all over our society that could really be remedied if we just understand the value of civility, understand that we have a requirement to serve one another and to have non-threatening conversations about the stuff that matters. And if we would do that, so many of these problems go away. And that, again, is going against the grain of what society says today. And that's the only reason I wrote the book is I don't have to be the moderator of the conversation, but if I could at least start people to thinking about the conversation, you know, maybe we can be a little better.
Well, you know, I was the other day I was at dinner with a bunch of friends and I realized that nobody wanted to. Everybody was all over the political spectrum. I'm more of a libertarian. Sure. I'm more of a libertarian. But I mean, most what I realized was nobody wanted to talk. Nobody would dare talk about religion or politics or anything because everybody was afraid it would dissolve into two camps shouting and screaming. And so we were kind of left to talk about things that didn't necessarily matter as much.
What a waste of time.
It was a waste of time, man. It really was a waste of time because then it just turns into grab ass and you're not really, nobody's having an honest discourse. And that's where the value, as I was reading your book, that's where the value of civility comes in. Because it comes down to respect for somebody's point of view. More importantly, it comes down to realizing you're both trying to solve a problem. But you're coming from two different angles, maybe. And it's very helpful. And you know, I think somebody one time said, when I don't agree with somebody, I actually listen to them twice as hard. I like that. I like that expression. Very difficult to do.
I think that's great. And you know, take your table, for instance. Hmm. I mean, what kind of takeaways could you have come from that evening? Other than the grab ass, and what kind of takeaways could you have come from that evening if everybody would have respected one another and civilly talked about their different thoughts? And what would be amazing is you guys would have found your differences, but more importantly, you also would have found a bunch of commonality you really weren't aware you had.
Exactly.
And that commonality then can create a foundation that you as a group can go forward from to try to build on. The problem is we've got a bunch of people in D.C. sitting around the dinner table like you and your friends were that are unwilling to have those civil, true, honest, candid, non-threatening conversations. Therefore, nobody's finding commonality. Therefore, we're broken, and that's why the country doesn't approve of what's going on out there, because there's no true leadership going on based around a civil discourse.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think it also comes back down to, you know, how you conducted yourself with the Manassas football team, because, you know, you didn't make winning the most important thing. The most important thing was really how they conducted themselves. And if we went into every conversation not looking to win and defeat our opponents and, you know, humiliate them, but really just in terms of conducting ourselves in a way that was based on civility and respect, so that, you know, we would come out of the conversation and say, you know, Brian did a really good job of listening, or he did a really good job of, you know, including everybody in the conversation, then suddenly the whole tenor of the conversation, the whole tenor of
yeah.
everything changes.
But also, Coach, one of the things I found was that it seems like the more successful and the more educated people get, and sometimes the more rigid they get, the more protective they get of their point of view.
I don't think that's necessarily true, because, I mean, the thing is, look at the Tea Party. I mean,
right.
you know, or look at the other side of the political spectrum. There are a lot of people who don't have two pennies to rub together who
right.
are just as arrogant. Like,
yeah.
arrogance is not something that is limited to the elites.
Hmm.
But
no.
to your point, you said, you know, if we sit around and he did a really good job listening and everything else, you know what happens when you get a group of people together that put that before winning and they actually approach a business or a football team or a political issue or a family? Do you know what happens when people actually do that? They do win.
Yeah.
That's the whole point.
Yeah.
If winning is the goal and that's it, you're going to lose.
Right.
But if putting it together on the right foundation and doing it the right way is the goal, then winning is the byproduct. That's the problem, is everybody's worried about winning, but they're not understanding how to go win.
Well, you said
that means in family, in football, in business, and that is a universal truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you said you don't coach football. You coach players that you coach kids that. Play football. You know, football
That's
doesn't.
Correct.
Yeah.
No, no.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't coach. I say it all the time when people say, "You're a football coach." I say, "No. I coach kids who play football." And they look at me and I coach kids on the tenets that are in my book, Against the Grain. I coach them on character, commitment, understand the dignity of hard work, perseverance, understand the value of a legacy, understanding what grace is, understanding that an entitlement attitude is destructive. I coach them on that. And then if you surround yourself with an army of kids who that stuff is their foundation, winning is easy, dude. The X's and O's mean nothing. And I'm going to tell you something. I built this business from nothing in a heavily asset-laden business that's against companies that have been around for hundreds of years. And when the economy fell, when we had the Great Recession, a good number is this to really illustrate to you. In 2004, the hardwood lumber industry in the United States produced 17 billion board feet of lumber. In 2011, it produced 4.5 billion. At that
wow,
same
wow.
time, right, there you go. Well, at that same time, my business doubled.
Ooh.
And I'm going to tell you, I'm going to tell you why. I surrounded myself with an army of people who believed in these tenets and came to work every day understanding these tenets are what carried us, not our pricing, not our production efficiencies, but these tenets carried us. And then our production efficiencies took care of itself. We don't have political issues in the office. All this stuff carries itself, and I'm telling you something else. That's exactly how we approach our family with our four children who are now 19, 18, 17, and 16, and my wife I've been married to for 22 and a half years. Certainly we've had disagreements, and certainly our kids drive us nuts. And, you know, it's not Beaver Cleaver, for God's sakes. We experience everything. But I'm going to tell you something. Every time there's an issue, we fall back to what is our foundation? What do our tenets, what does our principles tell us we're supposed to be doing here? And when we all open-mindedly, candidly, and civilly discuss what our tenets and our principles tell us we should be acting there, the answers come easy, and we win at family, too.
Yeah, there's
it's
no
that simple.
And watching you in that documentary, put your hands on that kid's knees and say, "I want you to come back to practice right now. You're going to come back like a man. You're not going to fight that guy. You just in some, you know, you are." Listen. The way you define leadership is another way. I want to read the tenets, because you're pretty undeniable, man. I mean, I feel like. like that. If I worked for you, I'd move to China too if I had to keep the business afloat. I mean, that guy picked up his family and moved to China. That's when you know you've got sway over a human being. He's like, you know what? You know what, Bill? I'm moving to China to keep this company afloat. You say leadership. Here are the characteristics that clearly distinguish a leader. They inspire those around them to believe in a cause or idea bigger than themselves. So it's about the game, it's about the team, whatever. They give credit to others when things go right and accept blame when things go wrong. They never ask people to do something they haven't already done themselves or wouldn't be prepared to do again. Now, that's so, those things you may have heard individually, but I'd actually never heard anybody put those things together. You obviously practice what you preach, and it's obviously been very, very effective. But it also, as you're talking about your family, you're talking about a team. The other thing I was thinking about is for my own relationship is, you know, I've been married now 7 years. I got two kids and my wife and I had an argument and, in front of her parents and, it got a little heated and her, and they were worried. Yeah. And her mom.
That's good.
Oh yeah. We got into it. Cause I'm the kind of guy who'll blow up and then I'm fine 5 minutes later. She'll hold a grudge for a year. She'll just sit, wait like a tiger in the tall grass and get me later. But we learned not only how to fight, but here's what really makes the marriage work. I told her parents this. They were worried. I said, let me explain something to you. I'm in this for the long haul, and here's why. I got three people under that roof whose happiness is basically more important than my own. And more importantly, I decided I'm not getting married a second time. First of all, it's too expensive with California divorce laws, so you can keep that crap. But at the end of the day, once we kind of said, look, man, we're going to go through our peaks and valleys, and I don't give a shit. I'm here. I'm stuck with you, sister. And these are my two kids who look at us as one unit. I'm not perfect. I'm sure I'm going to screw up. I hope it's not in a big way. But if it is, so be it. I'm in it. When you take that attitude, when you take that long-term commitment, and you talk about this too, if you start focusing on your feelings and what you need, I'm not in love with you anymore. Good luck, man. Good luck, because that honeymoon always ends. If you take that long-term approach, which is I'm in this forever because that's what it is, man. I don't mind. Bring it. I'll duck and I'll weave and I'll take shots to my face. But once you take that long-term commitment approach, I feel like things are way easier. I really do.
They are, because if you're in the backyard and there's a hole in the fence, you know that when things get rough, you can always run through it. But if you live in a backyard that you pass the holes in the fence and there are no holes and there's, you may bounce off the walls, but there's no getting out,
mm-hmm.
then you have a different approach to how you handle your backyard. And I think in marriage, you have to understand that the having to hold till death do us part does not have a tagline at the end of it that says, unless I kind of feel like I'm falling out of love with you or an upset. I mean, here's the other thing, and it's in the book. I'm sure you've read it, but right now, you guys, I don't know where your podcast is, but right now, your house could be burning to the ground. Right now, somebody could be in the parking lot still in your car. God forbid, and it's hard to think about, but right now, somebody could be murdering your kid or killing your wife or your mom or your parents. I mean, the truth is we have life insurance. We have car insurance. We have health insurance. We have homeowners insurance. We have all these things that make us sleep well at night, but the truth is it's just false security, because the truth is you have zero. All the things you think you have control over, you have zero control over. All of those things could be happening right now. Now, I'm not saying they should be. I'm just saying they could be.
Sure.
And you have to come to terms, to grips with, you have control over none of that, really. You do the best you can, but you don't have control over it. But you do have control over one thing, your word. Mm. Nobody can burn your word down. Nobody can steal your word. Nobody can kill your word except you. And if you understand that your commitment, your word, is the one thing in the world that you truly have 100% absolute, provident, divine control over, why is it that would be something that you would protect with everything you have and make sure that when you give your commitment to something like marriage, like somebody at your job, like your children, when you tell them you're going to show up to something, like people in politics, if you would protect that with the understanding that it's the one thing you actually have control over to protect, then you understand the importance of your word. And I feel like people are too cavalier with their word, and they don't understand the value of it. Well, and that's the whole point to the chapter on commitment.
Well, I got to tell you, if you worked in Hollywood, you would starve, man. I mean,
brother, I speak all over the country. I've shot a pilot to a TV show. I've done the Academy movie thing, and I'm represented by WME. And
You're doing pretty well, baby. No, you're right. I'm kidding.
I'm there. No, what I'm saying to you is, the last 2 years have been a little bit of an adjustment for me to understand what I'm dealing with.
Yeah.
And just like any place, though, there's good and bad.
Yeah.
And some keep the word and some don't.
That's
but
right.
The truth is, man, when it's the only thing you have absolute control over on this earth, why would we be so cavalier with it? I think it's stupid. And the other thing is, it's not, if you eat something today, you're going to digest it and poop it out in a couple of days. And your body, those are involuntary muscle responses that you have no control of. Your body just does it.
Yeah.
Your word is absolute voluntary.
And by the way,
if you want to make the commitment to do it.
I should also say that actually in Hollywood, your reputation is everything. I mean, you get away for a little while with being a liar. There's that old joke that says two producers are talking to each other and one says, wait a minute, you're lying to me. And the other says, I know, but let me finish. But you actually, you'll get away with that for a while. But at the end of the day in Hollywood, your reputation is everything. People check around. They
but
really
that's,
do.
That's
so,
true everywhere.
Yeah. So I'm being unfair. I was just being.
It is true everywhere.
Yeah.
But, it's also, a lot of people need to understand the value of commitment for sure.
Yeah, and
I mean that's the thing. When you read all of the literature on basically why societies work and why societies don't, I mean the big difference between a society like the United States and a society like Libya or Iran is trust.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Trust
sure.
that everybody will obey the laws, that the laws are above the rulers, and all of that sort of stuff. I mean, the example that Lawrence Lessig gives, which I always love, is in this country you can walk into a store, you can put down a piece of plastic, and walk out with a car. You know what I mean? That is to be able to rent a car is a tremendous level of trust. And you're not going to find car rental places in,
There was a constitutional scholar who said, our country is predicated on three things that a kindergartner could understand. One is keep your promises. Two is don't take what doesn't belong to you. And if you violate those two, the first two principles, fix it. The third is to fix it, to make amends, to put it back in its place. Honor the contract or put back
I
what
love
didn't.
That.
Yeah, it really was. I thought to myself, boy, that is basically the scaffolding on which our great society works, or at least it has
sure.
to. You have to make that argument, And I want to, before we go on, let's just talk a little bit about this cover photograph here. You're a rough guy. I like you in flip-flops, shorts, and a baseball hat. They threw you in this.
I wish I could send you a picture right now. I got my feet up on my desk at my lumber company, and I'm wearing black flops, black coaching shorts, and a t-shirt that says Bombers on it from the Mountain Home Arkansas Bombers, and a USC ball cap.
I mean, they combed his hair to the side. They threw you in this jacket. You couldn't be more uncomfortable in this blazer and this white, and I love what they did with your hands. Hey, coach, just put your hands in front of your. Who told you? This is so great. This is a guy who hates being photographed. This is the greatest photograph. You're just sitting there with your. What do I do with my hands? I guess I'll just put them in front of my belly here in a natural way.
That thing's a little rough. I'm not, I don't know.
Listen,
I mean,
listen, you're a cutie pie. You're a blonde. I got no problem with this.
Well, thank you.
Now let's talk a little bit, man. I this is great. And you really do have a way with words. I find myself getting inspired. I want to start running sprints for you. but I'm not built for football. I'm built for dance, unfortunately.
Got it.
The relationship between fear and fortitude. I really like that chapter. Expand on that a little bit, man, because fear paralyzes a lot of people. And it does.
The greatest barrier to success is fear. Mm. I mean, if you're so afraid of failure that you're unwilling to even try, that's a terrible thing because you'll never accomplish anything. And the fear of failure oftentimes is societal. You know, I don't want to look like I don't know what I'm doing. I don't want to start and fail, and people think I'm a failure. And you know, it's a lot of that kind of thing. And the relationship between that fear and fear of failure is how you overcome it, which is fortitude, which is strength. And I think the relationship between fear and fortitude is really interesting. Similarly, you know, everybody's heard the old adage that, you know, the closest to emotions are love and hate. Well, I think fear and fortitude are equally close, because it takes fortitude to overcome your fear. And once you understand how to handle fortitude to overcome fear, and you're willing to go attack things, that's when you will see success. Mm. So that's basically what the chapter is about.
Yeah. Yeah. It was something I mean, because so much of what is tough is getting people to, and getting yourself to, not only out of your comfort zone, but to take action, you know, along the lines of what your talent dictates. Do you ever find, though, that, you know, you have kids and stuff, and you're a coach, and you have this natural need to help people and motivate people. You're very good at it, obviously. But, you know, I've heard that sometimes, like, when you're a parent, and I'm just thinking, I'm asking this advice because as a parent, my kids will definitely do sports. They already are. And I've heard that sometimes parents can really kind of be too overbearing on a kid. They've done some research, and one of the things that kids really like to hear is when their parents say, I just love watching you play. But it's really difficult when you've got something to teach your kid. And it's really difficult when you've got, and a lot of times children want their own autonomy and they don't want to hear it from their parents.
Yeah, but that's also, again, it comes back to what Coach was talking about with process versus results. Mm. So often teachers have a thing that they want the kid to get, mm-hmm. and so they keep on trying to beat that thing in, rather than trusting that if they allow the kid to explore, you know, that they if you follow the process, the kid will come to understand the thing.
Mm.
Well, that's absolutely true. It's the old nature versus nurture issue. You know, I have four children, and they've all grown up with the exact same rules and the exact same everything, but they couldn't be any more dissimilar with regard to the way that they handle their homework, or with regard to the way they handle themselves socially, or with regard to the way that they approach, different challenges. Now, do they answer, and here's the point, do they answer the bell by and large in a way that makes me proud? Yes. So the lesson's there, but they each approach the way that they get to that answer completely differently. And and what that should teach us is that as a father or a mother, it's really not how you get there, as long as you get there right. Mm-hmm. And just because your kid may not be approaching a challenge or an issue the same exact way you would do it, as long as they're doing it morally and ethically and legally, and they're getting to the right place, you got to give them the freedom to be their own individual selves. Because no matter how you teach them, no matter how much you nurture them in your own way, they're going to have, nature gives them their own individuality. And if you try to suppress that and impress your own set of individual beliefs on them just because you're an adult and they're young, you're going to drive them away from you. You have to allow them the freedom within bounds. You have to allow them the freedom to express themselves and find their way in the way that they're built, as long as they're getting to the right place.
Well, it goes back to saying you coach kids not to, you know, to be good people, and the football kind of comes with it. So you focus more not on the, you know, because I think a lot of kids have, there's a lot of pressure if you get into a sport.
Makes me sick. Yeah. I mean, parents that try to live through their children on a field or a court or whatever, mm-hmm. they need to be taken out behind the woodshed. I mean, let the kid enjoy the game.
Yeah,
and support. And you're exactly right. Who a kid loves to hear, you know, I just really enjoyed watching you play. Mm-hmm. Not, hey, you did a lot of good things, but, you know, what happened on that one ball you caught, or what happened on that one tackle you missed, or mm-hmm. what happened? I mean, you know what? They're not stupid. They know they missed a ball. They know they missed a tackle. They don't need you to point out to them their failings. I mean, imagine if you had to go to work every day and somebody pointed out you did 99 good things and one bad thing, and your boss constantly talked to you about the bad thing you did.
Right.
Well, you'd hate it. And then we want to raise our children that way? That's ridiculous. You need to think about what you're doing. Now, eventually, the kid will come and say, you know, I missed that tackle. What should I have done differently? And then you take your opportunity to talk about it. I mean, it's, I, you know.
You're talking about inspiration. I mean, when you inspire a human being to do something, and that's really the trick. That's the whole point, I think. Is
the whole point.
Yeah, man.
It's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
It is. And here's the other thing. You know, we talked about leadership. You don't have to be the president of the United States. You don't have to own a company. You don't have to be the head coach of a team. You don't have to be the manager of a business unit. You can get out of your comfort zone. You can serve. You can inspire, and you can lead without ever leaving the bedroom. Mm-hmm. You can do it with the kids that are sleeping in the bedrooms down the hallway from you. Every one of us have an opportunity to serve and inspire and lead with these fundamentals, and you don't have to be ordained or elected or promoted to a big position to utilize the fundamentals that are against the grain to better your life and those around you. And the most important place you can do that to start with is at home. So it's universal for everybody.
Well, I mean, people think that leadership is a title, and it's not a title. It's an attitude.
It absolutely is. It's a good way to put it. It absolutely is a huge difference in a manager and a leader. Many times managers are leaders, yeah. But there's many managers that have no clue what that is.
Yeah, you make that distinction in the book, which I thought was really interesting. I mean, good companies and good leaders are people that inspire and create an innovative and happy workplace. I mean, that's Hunter had said, I don't know whose quote it was, but you can hold a gun to a man's head, make him lift a box, but you cannot hold a gun to a man's head and make him have a great idea. You know,
that's true.
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah,
that's very good.
Yeah, we give you little pearls here, Coach, for your next book. Don't kid yourself. That's what you get from the Brian Callen / Hunter Mott Show. We're not playing around here. I don't know what you think you're dealing with. What, some comedian / sometimes working actor? Nah.
One of the things that really came through for me in reading the book, Coach, is that obviously in the documentary Undefeated, we see how you dealt with the football team. But here in the book, you really get to see that this is a code of ethics, a way of dealing with people that applies in every aspect of your life, that it's true in your business, that it's true with your family. And I think that one of the areas in which you obviously go most against the grain is in dealing with race, because you didn't treat the players on your team any differently because of the color of their skin. You treated them the same way that you treated the employees at work or that you treated your own kids. And I think that that is something that we desperately need, is to really embrace the fact that we are all human, and what is true for one of us is going to be true for all of us.
Well, potential, human potential,
yeah.
Right? So regardless of where you come from, what your circumstances, economic circumstances, or how you grew up, if you're nurtured in the right way, everybody has potential to find out who they are.
The level of your character and the level of your character and the lean toward your success or failure and the level of whether or not you're good or evil has nothing to do with a zip code at the time of your birth.
Mm-hmm.
And when you understand that all of us are born failed, but we're all also born basically except for some sicknesses and stuff, but basically we're born as infants with a playing field that now has our nature in it, but also the nurture around us. You have to understand that the kids at Manassas are no different than the kids I've coached anywhere else. Mm-hmm. They have aspirations, they have dreams, they have goals. The only difference in them is the environment that they've grown up in. But when you're talking about fundamentals, not football, not socioeconomics, but you're just talking fundamentals, why then would you expect some African-American kids from the inner city to have any different aspirations and goals and wants and fears than any other kid? They're just kids. They're all the same. So while I appreciate what you're saying about the race thing, and it's been said a bunch, it frankly has no bearing on anything. Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly, and that's what I love, is the fact that you just don't buy into that narrative and you just deal with kids as kids.
Well, you talk about being...
I don't buy it. You know why I don't buy into that narrative? Because that narrative is a bunch of BS.
Mm-hmm. It is.
The narrative that oh, well, that's crap. Here's the thing. Level the playing field. Teach them the exact same things you teach any other kids and hold them just as accountable. And watch what happens.
Well, look, that's exactly what the documentary proves. I mean, that's exactly right. Human potential.
It's very simple. Yeah. It's really, really, really simple.
Well, you'll like this. We had Jared Diamond on the podcast who wrote a book called Guns, Germs, and Steel, a seminal book, basically answering the question. He was in Papua New Guinea, and a native there said, why do black people have nothing and you white people have everything? And he spent 20 years answering that question. It's a very, very good book. But one of the things that was fascinating is he took a Highlander. They took this kid who had been from the highlands of New Guinea. They'd been isolated for 40,000 years. Now think about this. 40,000 years. They had no tradition of writing or reading or arithmetic or anything else. And that kid was taken and nurtured in a Western atmosphere and ended up being a computer scientist at MIT. And that was one generation. Am I wrong?
No, I think there's a few details that Brian is sensationalizing.
Damn it, I like being dramatic.
Yeah, but the important point was is that, you know, his father was the first man in his village to read. And the point is that, you know, learning to read is just a question of being exposed to that. It's not a question of, you know, innate ability, right?
Didn't he become a computer scientist?
Yeah, right. But that right there speaks to what I was saying earlier, that your abilities and your whether your character and whether you're going to be successful or not has zero to do with the zip code or time of your birth. Yeah. We all have. I mean, that's the point right there.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I'm saying. And when you understand that and you approach every individual the exact same way, using the fundamentals and tenets that are against the grain as the foundation with which you do everything, amazing things happen.
Well,
it's really that simple.
And the point is that people adapt to their circumstances, whatever their circumstances, whatever zip code
certainly
they're in. And the challenge is basically to go against the grain, to rather than just conforming to what your environment is pushing towards, to say, no, this is who I'm going to be.
Okay, but so having correct said that, Coach, you know, having said all that, yes. But we're talking about day-to-day reality, okay? And so when somebody wakes up, and one of the things I find is it's one thing to read a book and get excited for the first week. But and yes, there are tenets in and that would work. But what would you say to people who have to motivate themselves every single day? Is there a question you ask yourself when you wake up every morning? What is the best way to do it? And I know everybody has different ways to inspire themselves, but how do you create lasting change, man, and habit?
You know,
it's kind of an unfair question.
No, it's not an unfair question. It's a great question, and it's like most of everything that I talk about, I really honestly think it's very simple. You know, all you got to do is look out the window, and the sun's coming up, and take one deep breath, and understand air's going in your lungs, and if you're an American, understand that you have liberties and freedoms unlike any society that's ever been on the face of this earth. So you got the sun in your face, you got air in your lungs, and you got freedom to make the decision that I'm going to do right today. And that's it. Mm. And then define what do right means. And do right means have character, be a person of my word. Understand that whatever I do today, I'm going to get dignity out of. Here's another thing. If you have a $2 an hour job, give it $3 worth of value and see what happens in your life. Go to work hard. And when you go home at night, be proud of the work you did because you got dignity that you're earning your keep and you did something that matters. And serve those around you and love hard and forgive hard and think about what your legacy is to your children and your friends and your society and people around you. And when you realize you have an opportunity to do all of those things every single day because the sun came up and you got air in your lungs, you got the freedom to do it, I don't know how you can't stay motivated on a daily basis. It's a decision that you just make.
Yeah, it's too bad they can't hear your voice. I like the way it gets me kind of pumped up. I'm like, all right.
Yeah, but I mean, and I think one of the things that is...
It's true, though. It's not easy, man. It really is.
And one of the things that you talk about in the book, and in terms of that phrase, do right, which I think is really, really crucial, is, you know, it's very, very easy to tell when what you're going to do or what you just did was not right. Like, we all know the things that are or are not right when we think about...
Well, I've been thinking about that a lot. I love that. I've been reading C.S. Lewis lately. I read two books of his, The Screwtape Letters and Mere Christianity. And, you know, he basically... And there's another book called The Moral Sense. But you know, you all... I mean, Socrates wrote about this. We all kind of know. Not kind of. You know what right conduct is. You know... We have a natural moral sense, I think, a natural idea of what fair play is. Well, every society knows that if you double-cross your friends, you're probably a shithead. We know.
I'll bet you those folks that spent 40,000 years in those hills, wherever the MIT guy came from, I bet you $50 to a penny that they know you're not supposed to lie, you're not supposed to take something that's not yours, and you're supposed to do what you tell people you're going to do.
Exactly.
I bet you $50 they know that.
I bet you, I would agree 100%. The only exception might have been the Mongols. But
maybe, but what I'm saying is, listen, it's very simple. Do right.
Yeah.
Because if you do right, you can't do wrong. And when anybody comes to me in my business or my kids or on my football team, and I got to talk to them about something that they didn't do right, they can start with all the justification and rationalizations, explanations, all they want. And all I got to do is look at them and say, well, did you do right? And when they say no, then, okay, so you did wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And they say yes. That's how easy that is. And then you forgive, and you go from there. And on the grace thing, one other thing very important for whoever's listening is, there's a huge difference in forgiveness and a pardon. I don't want people to think that this is some idealistic mumbo-jumbo that's impossible. When people do wrong, they got to be held accountable for their transgressions. If someone murders somebody, I'm not saying you forgive them and let it go. They're going to have to pay for those transgressions, but it doesn't mean that societally you don't forgive them in your own heart because it's best for you. John F. Kennedy said, always forgive your enemies, but never forget their names. And I think that's right. I mean, there's a huge difference in a pardon and forgiveness. I think that goes with doing right. I think it's all the same thing.
I think forgiveness also is easier when you start to realize that there's a murderer and a thief and a whore in all of us. I mean, you know,
no doubt about it.
You know what I mean? I mean, that's a very important thing to recognize in yourself. When you criticize somebody, listen, man, there's some of that in you too. And I don't care how straight a line you walk, it's always a struggle between, I mean, that's the sort of the certainly the idea between most religions is this battle between the beast, the flesh, and the spirit. You got these urges that take you one way, but you know that you're probably supposed to fight those urges most of the time. I mean, there's something called temperance. You don't have to abstain completely, but, you know, and so it goes. Life is a verb.
Well, it does, but the difference in the murderer and the thief and the liar inside all of us that is inside all of us, I couldn't agree with you more. And the ones who acted out are the ones who wake up every day, look at that sun, suck in that air, and make that decision to adhere to the fundamentals that we're talking about and against the grain, and make sure that that's the basis for their life rather than their own self-gratification and happiness.
Yeah,
you have to understand what comes first.
Yeah, the good has to be defended. You have to actually work at the good. I think it's a daily thing, man. It's a verb. It's not a noun.
And to that end, Coach, I mean, one of the things you talk about in the book is you talk about your family, you talk about your business, you talk about the team, and then you talk an awful lot about politics. Clearly, Washington is on your mind. You've been talking about Washington in this podcast. What is the deal? I mean, you know, is that a problem that you want to challenge next? Are you thinking of running for office?
So ever since Undefeated, I think the guy at Esquire asked me if I'd run for president. I can't remember. Maybe it was the LA Times. I can't remember. But anyway, I love politics. I find them fascinating. And I love to see good public servants at work, and there's a ton of them. So I don't want to paint with a too broad a brush here. But I also hate what the political system can do to people and what people can do inside of it if they are not founded properly. And so, yes, I do find it fascinating and interesting, and especially in our country where it can be a science to itself. Having said all that, first of all, I don't even know what party I belong to, and secondly, I opened my mouth too much and way too. I didn't go to law school, and I'm too candid, and I think it makes me unelectable. So, you know, in answer to your question, yeah, I'm really interested in it. I'm interested in the service. I tell you, some people, have you ever laid in bed and thought, if I hit the $400 million lottery, think of all the cool things I could do with that money, both for my family and other people. Have you ever done that?
Yeah.
Sometimes I lay in bed and think, man, if I was sitting there, these are the things I would do, and I know that would make things better. And I think a lot of us do that too. And so, yeah, I'm interested in it, but it's more of an intellectual fascination than a reality for me, because I honestly think I'm unelectable. I mean, I'm way right of center fiscally, and I'm left of center socially, and that leaves me without a home.
Well, but
I'll vote for you.
I think that's the whole problem, Coach, is I think that if most Americans are right on the financial side and they are left on the social side, you know, we want to save money, we want to be sensible, and, you know, we don't want to waste money. But at the same time, what you do in the privacy of your home, you're free to do, right?
Well, in other words,
that's how I feel about it.
Yeah, I mean, you're a Rockefeller Republican, and sadly, the Republican Party got hijacked, and, you know, by Richard Nixon, and, you know, the Republicans have never been the same, and the Democrats are, you know, off wandering in the woods with a bunch of failed policies. What we need is we need essentially a third party. We need people
like you.
The Bill Courtney party. Courtney.
Now you're. That's way beyond kind. But and I'm really actually humbled that you. I'll get aside. That's really kind. But there's no future in a third party in our country, and the problem is it just won't grow roots. And so what we have to do is we have to understand there are 10% on the far, far right that are absolutely out of their freaking brains. There's 10% on the far, far left that are nuts. And the 80% of us in the middle have to have civil, open, non-threatening conversations about the stuff that matters and take back our country in a way that makes sense from finding commonality. And as long as we continue to let the far, far, far right and the far, far, far left dominate the conversation, we end up, the very silent majority end up having to feel like we have to be pulled one side or the other to have any voice, and it destroys us.
That's
why I talk about D.C. so much, because I think these fundamentals, really genuinely, I think these fundamentals with some people with some courage who would stand up for the right fundamentals would fix a lot of things. And, yeah, I mean, Yeah, I'm very interested in it, but I honestly think I'm just one of those guys with a voice, unfortunately.
Well, I think there are a lot more people that agree with you than you think. I really do. I think that's one of the reasons that when people talk about being libertarian the way I do, that's exactly what I'm talking about. I just think that, you know, the idea that a central authority, whoever it might be, knows how to run your life, and you know, the government does two things for the most part: legislates and taxes. Those are both needed, but they are coercive acts at the end of the day. And if you allow any central authority carte blanche, they're going to just keep taking money and keep growing. And that's just a law of physics, I think.
Mankind.
My concern is that we have a populace that's beginning to fear the government rather than the government fearing its populace. And when that happens,
that's
lots
interesting.
Of deceit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's my biggest fear.
Well, because people don't have a voice.
That started to happen. I mean, look at the IRS thing. I mean, there's people in our society that are fearful of our government. Mm. And I don't mean the crazies living up in some mountain somewhere with a bunch of pipe bombs and water bottles. I'm talking about normal people are fearful of what the government's going to do next. Mm. And the government and the people in it should be fearful of what the people are going to do next at the polls.
Yeah.
And that just doesn't exist anymore. I mean, people that do crazy things continue to get reelected because they have name recognition and a ton of money behind them, and that's just wrong.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot on the politics.
And also
on the
because good people like you won't run because they think they're unelectable. I mean, I think that's the thing, Coach, is if you replay the last 10 minutes of this conversation in your head after it's over, and you imagine that one of your players had said it to you, I was just thinking the same thing. I don't think that you would be sitting there and saying, you know what, all of your doubts, all of your insecurities, all of your belief that, you know, you don't fit the mold of what you think a football player should be are right. And you should buy into and you should validate them. Going with the grain for you is basically continuing to say what you've been saying and hope that some Superman will come along and save our problems.
Time to go against the grain,
Time
Coach.
Time to go against the grain, Coach.
I think Hunter's saying you got to run for office. Sorry to put more on your plate. Yeah. Sorry to put more on your plate. He comes in to do an interview about his books, and we're like, hey, bro, at the end of the day, you got to run for office. Yeah. Time for you to run. So take those flip-flops off and get that jacket back on and go out there.
You want to know what's real funny, and then we're going to quit the political talk because y'all are just being embarrassing now, I've been approached by both the Democratic and the Republican Party, which I find humorous as hell.
Yeah.
Look,
well,
man.
Listen, you don't have to do it next week, but the point is I think that you are on a journey, and that journey leads to running for office on whatever terms you want to run.
Common sense.
But I think that's the point, and, you know, I think, you know, there's the law degree and there's all that sort of stuff, and we'll quit this, but... I just think that that's sort of the...
Listen, Hunter will work for you. Hunter will
absolutely.
Work for you. He's a smart dude. He went to Harvard.
Yeah, if you want... I mean, listen, if you ever... I mean, we have... Most of what we're doing on here is basically getting people on who we think have valuable things to say. And so we spend a lot of time thinking about what are the issues like campaign finance that really need to be fixed. And if you need...
Term limits in Congress.
Exactly. I mean, if you want to... If you ever want to have somebody that you can bounce a platform off of, we're here for you.
And
I
Coach,
mean, if we can support
Coach,
you.
Coach, I want to plug Hunter's book because it goes along the same lines. He wrote a book called The Straight A Conspiracy, which was basically the thesis was the idea that somebody is born smart. It was written for high school kids. It was the idea that you're born smart is the worst idea ever to come along. It's all about your mindset. It's all about, you know, the emotional state that you are in.
I agree with that so much.
It's a great book.
You know, there's another problem along those lines. Mm. Is the idea that you have to go to college to be successful is starting to get a little revolting, too.
Yep.
You know, there are a lot of master plumbers and master electricians that make well over $100,000 a year that you can go to trade schools in a year and work toward. You know, our transportation industry in the United States is in trouble. There is one driver for every two trucks out there right now, and an over the road driver right now can make $65,000 a year, no problem.
Wow.
You know, is it that you are supposed to be going to college? If you don't go to college and can't make it through college, then that's the end of it. I mean, there's so much to do. And here's what we do. We take kids who are just not prepared for college, or college isn't their speed or whatever, and we force, through No Child Left Behind and all the grants and everything, we force them into a college, and we get them in, but they're ill-prepared and don't have the ability to compete in college, and they struggle for a year or two, and the university takes all their Pell Grant money and everything else, and then they're out 2 years later, and they go back home, and it's like it's the end of the world because everybody's told me my whole life that college is the answer to everything, when there's all these jobs we have in the United States that are largely unfilled, that are good jobs, good paying jobs, that we don't have people to fill them because either you go to college or you bust. And I am so sick. I am so sick of that conversation. I can't stand it. We need to understand there's a lot of different ways to be successful in this country, and it isn't just taking kids out of the hood and putting them in college. It's ridiculous.
Well, and I mean, that's the thing. There's a great documentary that just came out, Ivory Tower, which is about exactly that, which if you haven't seen it, Coach, I would thoroughly endorse seeing.
Yeah. I will see it.
Well,
now that you said it.
There you go. Coach, I can't thank you enough, man. I mean, this the book is called Against the Grain, Bill Courtney. Thanks for coming on, man. I just consider it a privilege, and you're making a difference out there. And, you know, listen, I'm glad that this is the first time you've announced your run for presidency.
I appreciate it. Please, real quick, shameless plug.
Please.
You know, it's a national lease. You can go to CoachBillCourtney.com and hit any icon to your favorite online vendor. At CoachBillCourtney.com, you can read more about the book, or you can go to Barnes & Noble or whatever and pick it up, and you can follow me at I Am Coach Bill on Twitter, and there's updates daily about it. And honestly, y'all, I got a $45 million business that I've been very blessed with, and my family has been taken care of financially by virtue of this business, and writing this book has nothing to do with making royalties for me. It's about a conversation I think we need to have in our businesses and our family and our politics and our society. And I just hope some of your listeners will be motivated to go get a copy and read it and think about it.
Before we let you go, did you do an audio version? Because you should with your voice.
Yes, I did. And they were originally had a narrator, and I said no. And I canceled the deal, and then they called me back and said, okay. So I spent 4 days reading the book. And
oh, yeah, you're the guy for it.
Pickups and all that.
You're the guy.
So,
You can go
on Amazon. There's the Kindle version, the hardback, and you can get the audio version as well. So, yeah, there's an audio version of Against the Grain.
Get the audio version of Against the Grain. Listen to it in your car, and Coach Courtney will teach you life lessons in his brandy and soda voice. And his voice sounds like that, like a soft saw, like a soft saw cutting through cherry. You hear that?
I love it.
You're a good man. Awesome. You're a good man, Coach. Thank you so much.
You guys are great. Thanks for having me.
We appreciate
Thanks
you.
So much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
That was awesome.
Yeah, awesome.
He's a good man. That was a, listen, man, it's a good book. It's a good book. And he's just a thoroughly good human being.
Yeah. And I think
his voice is so clear. You could be, I would work for that guy. I actually might go to the lumber company. I have no skills in lumber. I feel like I my day would be great. I'd be like, Coach, can I get you coffee? And just give me a couple words of encouragement while I go out and saw some wood
wasn't that always part of your fantasy, was to be a lumberjack?
Well, yeah, a Christian lumberjack.
A Christian lumberjack in, you know, a small town in near Memphis.
Yeah, it's pretty hot. My fantasy, I don't look so good with a saw in my hand and sweat. And I just, you know.
But I'm sure a lot of it is machinery now. Like, it's not hand song. You can just sit there and push a button.
I know, but I want to be.
It's like
making
your espresso, Brian. You'd be able to relate to it.
I've always wanted to split wood with my shirt off. That's kind of,
but,
it doesn't. At 47, with my golf physique, I tried to split wood, by the way.
Did you?
It was sad.
How did it go?
They called me City Boy. and the wood didn't get split.
Oh.
So that's what I got going for me. Anyway, man.
Well, Brian, you know.
Yeah.
But the point is that, listen, what the coach has taught us is that, you know, being a lumberjack is about a code of ethics. It's not necessarily about a physique, right? You're focused on the result of splitting the wood, and you should be focused on, like, the values and the principles.
You and your discipline and principles and good talk. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you enjoyed that. I know I did. And there it is. Hunter Motz, thanks once again for getting our guest.
This was a listener recommendation. He said,
oh, really?
We should get him on. And then I reached out to him about the documentary. And then he's like, I have a book coming out.
The guy's got a great voice, man.
Yeah, he does.
I mean,
he does.
That voice of his. I mean, he said, no wonder he was a coach. All right, man. That's enough.
All of the books, everything else, will all be available through the website as well. But you can obviously get it for...
I'd recommend listening to that guy speak, man.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's a cool, you know, it's a good book for he's got just a great voice for that stuff. All right, man, I've said that enough. I'm boring myself. Ladies and gentlemen, I gotta go move out of my house. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.